Accession number 18537, Reel 2.
Could we get back to the narrative now? I think the last place you were describing was your time at Sherburn, where you were selling AOP to the various artillery.
Yes, indeed. Well, he went on doing that until I was going to say all the time, really, until Normandy invasion of 1944. But we had a lot of work because combined operations claimed us, and we spent much time in the north of Scotland, particularly based on Dalcross Inverness, now Inverness Airport, and working with the Navy and the land chaps then, it being very doubtful as time went on whether the Navy were going to be able to produce a carrier from which we could operate during D-Day. And in the end, of course, they said, no, very sorry chaps, no good. You'll have to go in by sea, find yourself a landing ground. And that was my task, as far as 652 Squadron were concerned.
You actually did some flying training from carriers, didn't you?
Yes, indeed, two lots. Yes, the Argus and the Ravager. The Argus being the training carrier, the Ravager was a smaller escort carrier. And that was fascinating, and we were able to train for that at Ayr, Heathfield Air, which is next door to Prestwick. And we had a deck landing control officer with us for 2 months, and a chap called Tony Lacayo, who was very good, and he fitted in very well with the squadron. And we did hundreds of aerodrome dummy deck landings, you know, on a specially marked strip on one of the runways. It worked very well. And we had the Auster 3 by that stage, which was a slightly more powerful aircraft in it, a Gypsy Major engine, 130 horsepower. It had flaps, which were excellent, large flaps. It had a huge lead weight in the tail to counterbalance the engine. It had only an hour and 10 minutes endurance, which was, of course, an absolute dead loss if one was going anywhere. And the Auster 3 was, in many ways, a vast improvement, because we could then land very short indeed, sort of coming in, hanging on the prop. And we could also, of course, take off really remarkably quickly.
You actually lifted off, didn't you, and hovered?
Well,
if you had a good, say, a 30-knot wind across the deck, and the ship was travelling at about another 20 knots.
Oh, as far as the aircraft was concerned, the aircraft carrier, yes.
Yeah.
the great thing was it didn't matter on the Argus, because the island retracted during flying training. I imagine much to the relief of the commander flying. And the on the other hand, on the Ravager, they had this great structure, and one just had to be jolly sure that one didn't veer right into it. But that worked very well. And the Auster 3...
That you didn't need an arrestor hook to land on.
No, luckily the deck landing, deck handling party were large chaps with big hands and feet, and were able to grab the aircraft as soon as we landed. Because you see, you were actually, I could say, coming in at a very, very slow rate. And
did the ship actually have to slow down to allow you to...
No, they didn't slow down at all. And the wind over the deck, you see, was about 40 knots. And we were coming in rather at that speed. And having, if you approached the carrier on a sort of normal circuit, you sort of came across wind, level really with the stern of the aircraft, the stern of the carrier,
yeah.
And then just turned in and landed. It was some hilarious process, and the commander of the Argus, the captain of the Argus, was heard to remark on one occasion to the commander flying, "Tell me, Mackenzie, what is going on this morning? I cannot understand this Pongo aviation," which I think was a very, very fair comment. But we didn't break anything, and it really worked very well. But, as I say, no carrier for Normandy itself. So all the combined operations stuff that we'd taken part in worked as expected. And because my particular flight was in support of the 3rd British Division, which was right on the east end of... it was Gold Beach,
yeah.
Right by Wieström. Mm-hmm. That's where we landed. And we had a vehicle, a waterproof vehicle, and that was well laden with explosives and some aircraft fuel and a small motorcycle and 5 chaps and 1 officer who were in support. And it really worked quite well because I dropped them in a secure-ish sort of place and went off on the motorcycle to look at the 3 field areas that we'd selected from vertical air photograph cover.
When did you actually land?
I should have landed at about 12 noon on D-Day, but because of the slowness of the build-up then, it wasn't till about 7:30
in the evening.
In the evening.
How deep was the bridgehead then?
Well, I think probably if you said about 1.5 miles, but it varied quite a bit. And after I looked at the first field, which was off to the east of the road that went down to the Orne Bridges, Pegasus Bridge, that was no good because it was full of crash gliders and parachutes and anti-landing poles and general clutter. And there was no cover for the aircraft except to the east. And it was in full view of the enemy anyway. So I departed from that and went off to look at the second field, which was to the northwest, and was alongside the lateral road that ran east and west from Douvres-la-Derivrande, and turned out to be a minefield. And it also had big trees at the eastern end of it, bigger than we'd realized from the air photograph. And so that left the third one. Incidentally, progress to the second field had to be halted for a little time because there was a regiment of infantry moving southwestwards. I was going northwestwards, you see, and I had to wait till these steps had gone on in a southwesterly direction before I could proceed towards my second field. So, anyway, they cleared themselves off and were, I think, latterly surrounding a strong point at Douvres-la-Derivrande, which held out for a day or so. And then I was able, having dealt with the second field and abandoned that rapidly, I went southwestwards from there to the village of Plumto, and the large farm there, and there was an area of ground which really turned out to be very satisfactory. Once we'd cleared a whole lot of obstructions, we had to blow up a number of electric pylons and a concrete water tank and remove lots of wire fences and things, but we did that. and by dark on D plus one, the place was ready for use. And one of the chaps in my flight called Bob Linton, who died last year, Captain R.E. Linton, was by that stage ashore and at the 3rd Divisional Royal Artillery Staff Headquarters. And Bob's job was to send a message back to the squadron. He'd got two RA signalers with him, and they'd come ashore on the top of a submersible tank, a swimming tank, with a sort of pram thing on which the radio was. And so that worked satisfactorily. And I'd established contact with Bob on the radio earlier. Told him that after he got the message through satisfactorily, he would come back to the squadron landing ground at Plumto.
What was, when you were going round exploring sites for your base,
yes.
What was the sort of scene you beheld? I mean, massive destruction? I mean, were the locals emerging from their shelters?
No, no sign of locals at all.
Really? They'd all abandoned them?
I think they'd all gone. Because...
lots of dead animals?
No, fortunately, the Plumto area, the farm was clear. There were no dead animals, as I'd expected to find. We came across them later.
Was there heavy fighting there at that time, was there, I think?
Well, not a great deal, because I think the Germans realised that there was a great deal of force ashore, and they were departing southwestwards and southwards towards Caen. And it was really, in a way, once the infantry had gone on and finished their little battle, and I was sort of able to get on the motorbike again and explore around Plumto and make sure it was all right. And it was very fortunate because it was below what we call the Perrier Ridge. There was a ridge running from Perrier-Laudon westwards, and that shielded the Plumto landing ground from the view of the Colombel cement factory, on which there were obviously German OPs. And we were able to operate from there over the next few weeks very satisfactorily. The great thing was that any visiting aircraft should have been told to keep very low as they approached and not do as one visiting squadron commander did, which was to fly over at 200 feet, do a perfect circuit and landing, and giving a clear indication to the German OP, of course, where we were. And we had one very large round the following day, which buried Captains Linton and Clark in my flight. They were sitting, minding their own business, drinking tea in Jeff Clark's trench. And this shell arrived, luckily, alongside their trench and buried them temporarily. And luckily, my driver, Batman Gunner Clark, dug them out. I mean, it was largely through his initial efforts that we got them out safely. And they were last seen waving from the back of a 1500-weight truck, a rapidly emptying whiskey bottle, and they returned to duty the next day.
Anyhow, once you'd chosen your airfield...
Yes.
You called up your aircraft from...
Yes, Bob Linton got the message back. And at 8.15 the next morning, the first five of the squadron aircraft arrived, having been escorted across the channel by a Walrus aircraft. And
Mother Goose.
Yes, jolly good, because the Navy were apt to just let loose. Because I went back some little time later, about a fortnight later, just after the big gale, to collect a replacement aircraft, because there have been two chaps lost from other flights in the squadron. So I was able to get back and collect a replacement aircraft, and Captain Harry Borden, B-A-W-D-E-N, collected the other one, and we arrived back at Plumeto very heavily laden indeed, with a vast amount of food and some beer and so on. And so the squadron was up to strength. But it was a very satisfactory time in that we did an enormous amount of shooting. In my article, I've given the sort of squadron number of shoots, I think it was 800 and something, in the first period. And
this was mainly directing naval guns, was it?
No, it was. It included, I think I did 55, it was, shoots with the Navy. No, most of the shooting was with the regimental field guns in support of 3rd Division and also the number 5 AGRA, the Army Group RA, which were the medium guns. And it really worked very well.
Now, when you're looking up for enemy batteries on which to lay fire...
Yes.
Presumably you were looking out for gun flashes, were you? Because I would imagine...
Yes, there were a lot of flying at dawn and dusk. That was very useful because you could see the flashes. And by that stage, we've got to know the countryside really pretty well. And so we're able to pinpoint, in many cases, these hostile batteries, which could be given attention, I would say, throughout the rest of the day. Well, that worked.
What about German armoured units, mobile units? Did you spot
them? You very rarely saw... I only saw German tanks on two occasions, and they were sort of moving into other cover. But I think we had quite an effect in quieting things down very often, which was good.
Were you interfered with much by aircraft?
Yes, there were a lot of German fighters in the early stages, and we were very lucky in that the light anti-aircraft regiment in our sector was commanded by Charles Baisley, who had been the commander of 651 AeroP squadron and really the instigator of AeroP, an enormous enthusiast for AeroP right throughout. And Charles, of course, was very well known to us and was a good friend. We had a sort of special relationship with his regiment. They shot down 11 German fighters in the first 3 weeks in Normandy. And we had a lot of interference, really, and the warning of bandits came quite regularly, and we were able to get down. There were two chaps lost from other flights in the squadron, and one was shot down, the other, it was just a matter of bad map reading. He got himself too far forward and was shot down by a light attack. But the light anti-aircraft fire was really tremendous. They were very good indeed.
This was what mainly Beaufort and guns like that.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I was very expert. But, I was doing a shoot on one occasion very much higher than normal. It was about 2,700 feet. Some far distant battery that we were trying to register. I was in the middle of this shoot, and there was a battle between four Spitfires and three FW-190s going on sort of all round. So they were far too busy shooting at each other to worry about me, which was fortunate. And that was good. Mm. It's quite fun.
So you were really observing for ground-based weapons at the time. You didn't call for any airstrikes or any typhoons? Or
no, we didn't. There were typhoons, actually, on an airstrip on the top of the Perrier Ridge, now that's to the southeast of us, and they were in view of the Colombelle factory, and they got shelled quite a lot. We got the overs, but that didn't really matter very much because we'd borrowed an armoured bulldozer and we'd dug pits into which the aircraft could be run down. So their wings were virtually at ground level, and so any shell splinters and things didn't do damage, which was fortunate. But it worked.
Did you fly with parachutes?
A parachute?
Did you wear parachutes?
No. No.
Not much point, I suppose. Really.
Not really. Absolutely none at all. There was a time when we wore parachutes at night, but that really was, again, a waste of time because the night flying was a nonsense. I mean, it wasn't really awfully satisfactory. And we also wore, very briefly, some armour plating underneath and at the back and underneath the seats of the aircraft, but that didn't help the performance at all, and was abandoned very, very rapidly. The night flying, really, I think, in Italy and in Africa would have been all right, but not Northwest Europe. This night haze I'm talking about was prevalent.
Yeah.
Not good.
You mentioned earlier that you'd directed the Rodney's guns at the Mullican Tunnel.
Yes, yes.
I imagine those shells coming over were quite spectacular, weren't they?
Well, it certainly produced a spectacular result. Mm. I mean, I'd flown out on a very grey day from Heathfield out to the Rodney, which was off the north end of Arran. Mm. And the radio, of course, no trouble at all at that stage. And gave the orders to fire and so on. And there was this colossal sort of explosion of mull. Very, very satisfactory.
Because I was thinking mainly off Normandy, because you had what the Americans call a lot of heavy ordnance there. You
yes.
Not only the Rodney, but you had the monitors as well.
Yes, Roberts and Roberts, yeah. So on. Yes, very effective. But the snag, of course, that, they ran out of targets.
Because of the range.
Yes, you see. After that, there was a sort of breakout. And we were so busy moving on up towards the Seine and so on. And it wasn't really till we got to Le Havre that the battle got on again. And because we were investing Le Havre by that stage and doing a lot of counter-battery work, because the Germans had got a formidable amount of anti-aircraft stuff in that area, and we were able to annoy them considerably.
So, after the breakout from Normandy, presumably you continued your good work following up the advance.
Yes, and we went, as I say, to Le Havre, and then we went on and had a private war at Dunkirk, because the Germans were still holding on to it. And there was a curious mixed force, which was commanded by somebody called Major General Ray Leakey, who whom I came across in long, long years later. He was secretary, I think, at that stage of the Wellcome Foundation, years and years afterwards. But the Dunkirk battle was just an episode, really, and from there we moved up north of Antwerp and encountered V2s and things, sort of a bit tiresome, and then on up to Rosendahl and Breda, south of the River Maas. And up there, of course, the weather conditions were not awfully good in sort of late-ish autumn. And it was while we were at Breda, or near Breda, that I was suddenly whistled back to Brussels to 21 Army Group. The chap who had been the squadron captain, the sort of second in command, John Nicholson, took over B Flight, and they had a somewhat difficult time because the four chaps who commanded 5, 6, 7, and 8 sections were all, like me, territorially minded, and John Nicholson was a regular soldier. So they had a bit of difficulty settling down, but it managed.
From a formal discipline point of view.
Yes, and attitudes, the way things were done, and so on. Anyway, I'm delighted to say that I've had contact with John Nicholson, who lives in Christchurch, New Zealand, and he and his wife came here about 18 months ago. Very nice to see them after a long gap. So we've had contact continuing.
But now, you spent a long time practicing and sharpening your training.
Yes.
In the years before D-Day. D-Day was your first exposure to active service, essentially.
Yeah.
Now, as you progressed after D-Day, mm-hmm. through eventually to Germany, I suppose, mm. How were your techniques sharpened and improved and so on? How would you compare your activities at D-Day and thereafter with the ones before the end of the war, your specialities?
Well, I think the answer is that one had reached a point of efficiency and experience just sort of after D-Day that wasn't improved on thereafter. The shooting became that much easier with experience. The more shoots one did, the more different caliber of guns that one was firing, that one was directing. The map reading was still being honed, obviously. I was lucky because when I was at 21 Army Group headquarters, the RA staff, I had an aircraft, you see, and so I was able to get around and see what the Americans were up to. And
your personal officer?
Yes, yes, really very useful. And I didn't succeed in teaching the MGRA to fly, but he was a reasonably passive passenger on most occasions. And we had a marvellous time because we watched the Rhine crossing from above, about 4,500 feet, and without interference, which was absolutely splendid. And at that stage we were at a place called Suchteln, so short of the Rhine, and it was a very interesting time. And then, of course, the battle finished, and I wasn't needed anymore. I didn't need an aircraft anymore. And so I went to work in the Chief Signal Officer's branch on what was called air dispatch.